Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. On June 24th, 2022, the Supreme Court issued the following decision, quote, held, the Constitution does not confer a right to abortion. Roe and Casey are overruled, and the authority to regulate abortion is restored to the people and their elected representatives, end quote. With that, Roe v. Wade, the federally protected right to abortion, ended 49 years after the court's landmark decision on a woman's right to choose. In a new book, The Fall of Roe, The Rise of a New America, New York Times reporters Elizabeth Dias and Lisa Lehrer chronicle the incremental 10-year battle won by anti-abortion activists, judges, and political and religious factions. Dias and Lehrer detail how a mix of relentless legal activism, lucky breaks, and broken political norms combine to shock progressives and embolden conservatives. Since then, abortion has become a winning issue for Democrats in red and blue states alike. But the presidential election will test the limits of that political currency, and no matter who wins, the conservative-dominated court seems likely to severely limit abortion access for a generation or more. The authors join us today to discuss their book and how abortion access is likely to affect the realms of politics, healthcare, and gender equity in the months and years ahead. Elizabeth Dias, Lisa Lehrer, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thanks so much for having us.
Well, thanks for being here. Before we get into the book, I think listeners would be interested to hear how the two of you approach this subject. Elizabeth, your reporting focuses on religion, while Lisa's emphasizes politics. How do those perspectives compare and contrast when it comes to abortion?
Well, Lisa and I actually joined the New York Times around the same time after former President Trump was elected, and really shared a vision for cultural politics and the way that our politics and culture interact. And this issue, particularly abortion, we really feel can't be fully understood unless you understand both of these components, right? The motivations of the anti-abortion movement are so deeply rooted in many conservative Christian values. And that's been longstanding, not just this last, you know, presidential cycle, but years, decades, and for generations of values, particularly in the Catholic Church. And so the way in which religion motivated and sort of underpinned the anti-abortion movement is central to understanding how our world changed when it comes to abortion, but also casting forward and thinking about a wide array of issues and values that one segment of the country is working to further right now.
We also felt that this was an issue that had largely been covered in ways that were partisan or polemical over the, you know, its 50-year lifespan since Roe. And we thought it was really important to cover both sides of this thing, cover it with a fierce eye to independent journalism, and really take this like a nonpartisan, almost clinical approach to both the politics and the religion, because this has proven to be a major political driver and issue in our politics, certainly since Roe fell. And it deserves, we felt, that kind of treatment to really understand what happened here with Roe. And we also think that you can't understand what's going to happen with this coming election unless you fully know this story. So that was another thing that we really endeavored to do in both our respective disciplines.
And Elizabeth, I think you mentioned that the two of you came to the New York Times during at a similar period. How long did it take for the two of you to overlap in your reporting? In other words, were you thrust together immediately, or did it naturally happen? Did you gravitate to one another? How did that occur?
we became friends quite early in the reporting. You know, when you're working on some really tough reporting, right? It was a very dynamic time for the country and for politics right ahead of the 2018 midterm election. And so there was a lot of teamwork that we were doing. We covered certainly abortion stories together. We did a road trip across I-20 in the South, going to some of the remaining abortion clinics down there and covering just what was going on the ground and how much the country was changing. And, you know, it's just really great to do your work with someone who, you know, you can really learn from and trust. And I think that we really enjoyed that. And we really kept learning from each other in our respective fields. And so we just found that combination was really beneficial to the reader, really, in understanding a much bigger picture of what was happening in our country.
So you've worked together, obviously, for a good while. You've been covering this issue, and as Lisa said, in sort of a clinical, dispassionate, neutral way, which is very difficult to do on this topic, probably more difficult than any other topic in the world. And now you get to 2022 in this momentous decision, and you decide to do the book. So how did you divide the work and determine what to include? Because I think that must have been very difficult, because this subject can and has filled many, many, many books and documentaries and so on. So how did you approach that?
It was actually quite difficult. We did a ton of reporting and research. We did more than 350 interviews with people. We created a document that was functionally the first sort of collection of all the coverage and news and archives about this. But what we tried to do was we felt that the early sort of phases of the abortion rights battle, the 1970s, the 1980s, had been pretty well documented. And what hadn't been as documented is what we took to calling the final decade of the Roe era. Because it turned out that Roe was an era just like all these other things in American life, that it was something that had a start and an end date. And we wanted to look at that period, that final decade, because it's also a period when our politics changed pretty dramatically, when our political parties changed, when both the Republican and Democratic Party changed. It's the period that charts the rise of former President Donald Trump. So it's a period where a lot of things are changing in American politics. And in terms of abortion rights, it's a period when the anti-abortion movement became a lot more radical in some ways, and their ambitions grew. So our book really starts in 2013, which is, of course, when President Obama is reelected. It's a period that the anti-abortion movement saw as their lowest point. The Republicans at that time were saying, this issue is a loser for us. We need to move away from fighting abortion rights. Many people in the anti-abortion movement believed that Roe couldn't be overturned, but they decide to fight back. And then over the course of this very tumultuous and momentous decade that so many of us have lived through, all of this changes. And you come to 2022, and there is that case at the Supreme Court, you know, being overturned by this court that has now been transformed by Donald Trump and a Republican Senate. So we sort of narrowed our approach to really hone in on this decade that we thought was so important and really hadn't been covered in the same way that the earlier phases of this fight had been.
So let's talk about that decade. You tell the story of Roe's fragility and fall through many people and voices, as you mentioned, but the leading roles go to two fiercely determined women on opposing sides. Cecile Richards, the former head of Planned Parenthood, and Marjorie Dannenfelser, the president of Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America. Let's start with Cecile Richards. Here she is in 2021 discussing abortion as a means of political motivation in an interview on the Obama presidency.
Unfortunately, I mean, it's interesting. Some of this happened as I was coming into Planned Parenthood, but had been building over many years. And that is that the issue of access to safe and legal abortion, to access to birth control, access to sex education, had increasingly become a partisan issue, which makes no sense because, of course, whether it's the patients that come to Planned Parenthood or just everyday people, everyone needs those services. It's not a partisan issue. But if you looked at the United States Congress, United States Senate, it had increasingly become this issue in particular had been divided by party. Personally, I believe and continue to believe for not because people actually opposed those things or even opposed Planned Parenthood, but it was really felt like it was the way to gin up a base of voters that they needed to be determinative in elections. That means the most extreme right or the evangelical vote in the Republican Party. And unfortunately, people who in the Republican Party who'd been supporters of Planned Parenthood, supporters of these issues, had fallen away.
So I want to ask you, why did you choose her as a central figure, and what do you think her legacy is going to be in the abortion fight?
Well, look, she was the most dominant, well-known figure in abortion rights, really over this decade. She played a huge role. She was a force. She was she's very well-known still. And she really worked to try and rally Democrats around the issue of supporting abortion rights. And in some ways, she was successful. I think over the course of her tenure, abortion rights became an issue that Democrats, fewer and fewer, you saw this decline of the anti-abortion Democrat. There were fewer and fewer self-proclaimed pro-life Democrats. It became as much a litmus test for the left as it did for the right. But what I think Cecile Richards was battling was this persistent sense of denial. Look, people are always more activated to fight for change than for the status quo. It's hard to really rally people to get out there and protect what they have, and so there was this sense, particularly among the Democratic voting electorate, that Roe was not something that was really at risk. These Democratic politicians could come out and warn about it falling. And it was hard for people to imagine that this thing that was so integrated in their life two generations could suddenly disappear. So I think for all her efforts, she really couldn't in the end combat this and outrun this sense of denial that was pervasive among many sort of average supporters of abortion rights.
I think one of the important things that you point out in the book is that when she was running Planned Parenthood and she was closely aligned with the Obama campaign and then presidency, that Barack Obama had made a campaign pledge to codify Roe, and
yes,
he later abandoned that. I think that so much has happened since, maybe that's gotten lost a little bit, but zero in on that a little bit. What happened? Why did he abandon that? And was there much pushback at the time?
So it's interesting. He did make that promise. It was clearly not a priority. He abandoned it within 90, his first 100 days of office. He said, we're not going to focus on this. And there were just other priorities. They wanted to do the healthcare law. They wanted to do something on climate, maybe on immigration. This was really at the bottom of the list. However, all that being said, what people forget is that Democrats couldn't have passed that. They did not have a Democratic majority in the House that supported abortion rights. And you could see that in the negotiations over the healthcare law that were going on. There were several Democrats who did not want, quite a robust faction of Democrats who didn't want to support Obama's healthcare law unless it included protections that ensured that abortion rights, as you know, the course of creating these new healthcare exchanges, would not be expanded. So even if that codifying abortion rights into federal law had been a priority, it's really hard to see how Democrats would have had the votes at that time. And in fact, Democrats did not get an abortion rights majority in the House until 2018.
That's the voice of Lisa Lehrer. She is our guest along with Elizabeth Dias. They are the co-authors of the new book, The Fall of Roe, The Rise of a New America. We need to take a break, but when we come back, we'll have much more on the final 10 years of Roe v. Wade and what lies ahead. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guests are Elizabeth Dias and Lisa Lehrer. They are reporters at the New York Times, and they are the co-authors of the new book, The Fall of Roe, The Rise of a New America. So when we took a break. We were talking a little bit about Cecile Richards, the former head of Planned Parenthood. The other protagonist that I mentioned is Marjorie Dannenfelser. She has North Carolina roots. She grew up in Greenville, and she graduated from Duke in 1988. She also went from pro-choice Republican in college to anti-abortion and lifted the effort at a time when Republicans were ready to dump abortion as an issue. Here is Dannenfelser speaking with the Washington Post in 2022 about a possible federal abortion ban.
It is our job to be as ambitious as we can be and building consensus in every legislature. The Congress is a legislature also. And California babies at 6 months deserve protection, and they're probably not going to get it right now from their legislature. So that is where the federal role comes in. If it's a human right, it's a human right everywhere. So ambitious as you can in the Congress is as ambitious is not the same level of ambition that you're going to have in Minnesota, California, Alabama. It's going to be different because each state and the Congress has its own DNA, its own fingerprint, and its own way of building consensus and passing laws.
And in the same interview, she discussed the likelihood of abortions continuing at the same rate or higher and possible increased risks.
Well, I think all human rights battles have had similar things thrown at them. It's pointless. It's useless. It's going to go on no matter what you do. There will always be human misery. Just let it keep going. I don't think that's acceptable. I think what we do is we address. It's a lot easier to say that than it is to address the true concerns and needs of women while we protect the rights of their unborn children.
So I'll ask you the same question, although it's obvious, you know, why she's a central character. But what do you think her legacy is going to be in the abortion battles, particularly the last 10 years that you're focused on?
Mm-hmm. Well, Marjorie Dannenfelser was absolutely, it is absolutely a key figure in the anti-abortion movement. And we were really struck in our reporting by the role of conservative women and not just men, right, in the push to end abortion rights. I think it's been easy for many people to think about the religious right as a movement, but really thinking about what it was, the legacy of that movement from the 70s, 80s, and even early 90s, when it was a very male-dominated movement. But at the time, in the early 90s, one of the things that got lost, I think, in the public discussion, or just really maybe hadn't been examined before, was the rise of a new kind of woman in politics, which is the conservative women who opposed abortion rights. It 1992, as some of your listeners may remember, was touted as the year of the woman. When Hillary Clinton came to Washington as first lady, it's when Democratic senators, women like Dianne Feinstein, came to Washington, and there was this rush. It was Ruth Bader Ginsburg nominated and confirmed to the Supreme Court. So there was this big push of liberal feminism taking root in Washington. But what was missed was at that same time, there was a group of young, mostly Christian, conservative women coming to Washington in their 20s, just out of college, getting married, who looked around and said, this is not the vision of womanhood that we want, specifically tied to abortion rights. And one of those women was Marjorie Dannenfelser. There were other women that she was working with, you know, in her crew at the time, like Kellyanne Conway, mm-hmm. who went on, of course, to be a central advisor to former President Trump. And they really pushed against the grain and started thinking in generational terms instead of just, you know, a 2 or 4 year election cycle about how they could affect change. It's one of the things that they're most successful in thinking about how should they as a movement affect change in the long term, because they were up against these also generational forces, and it became a real strength of Marjorie Dannenfelser's and women she was working with of not looking at losses as the end, right? It was just part of the journey to get to where they wanted to go, and it made them quite successful. And she was the woman who, after President Barack Obama was reelected, said, "No, we refuse to be cast out of the Republican Party," even though at the time many in the party were thinking that his election meant that the country was going in another direction, right? That's same-sex marriage was becoming legal in several states, and people just cast out the idea that the Republican Party could be a party that opposed abortion. It just seemed like this was not the direction the country was wanting to go, but she and her crew of women doubled down and just insisted that this was going to go another direction. So now it's very interesting because she and her movement are, or she and her organization are pushing for still a federal abortion ban, which has become quite unpopular just because the foundation has shifted and people understand in a way they didn't before that the end goal of her movement is actually to end abortion entirely, right? It's not actually about finding some consensus ground, but she's facing new obstacles that I don't think she or many other in her movement could have imagined before Roe fell.
That's the voice of Elizabeth Dias. She is a New York Times reporter, and with her New York Times colleague, Lisa Lehrer, who is also with us, is the author of the new book, The Fall of Roe, The Rise of a New America. I'm not sure which one of you to steer this to, so I'm going to just throw it out there. But as Elizabeth is detailing Marjorie Dannenfelser and the movement that really led to the end of Roe, one of the things that's really interesting is, as you say, this was an argument dominated by men for so long. And this group of young women comes in and they finish the job, so to speak. And I'm curious, how important do you think it was or is that they are women in terms of maybe feeling this more viscerally on top of their political talents and their intellect and all the things that go into this, but having a more relentless pursuit? Do you think there's any difference because of gender? And I know that's a very dangerous question maybe to even pose, but I'm just curious, like, you know, how do you view that? Because it can be interpreted in some ways reading the book that while the men who were against abortion pursued it avidly, when this group of women came in, they simply would not stop. They would not relent. They were going to pursue this to the end. I don't know if that question makes sense, but please try and make sense of it.
Well, I think there's two pieces to your question. One thing that we noticed and that we really tried to bring out in this book was the personal experiences that all the people on the front lines had with abortion or with, you know, family planning or with having children who had sort of, you know, difficulties and, you know, fetal abnormalities that doctors told them to end the pregnancies. And sometimes they did and sometimes they didn't. So there was something here where there is this personal connection that a lot of these activists on both sides of the fight have to this issue. But I have to say that I don't think that's unusual. I think the reason abortion has emerged as such a salient issue in our political life is because it is so intimate, because everyone just understands this. I like to say, if you had a baby, if you've known someone who's had a baby, if you've been a baby, there is something about this issue that you understand at like a visceral gut level. And I think that's really clear in the reporting that we did about some of these activists' like personal ties to it. On the anti-abortion movement, I think this also was a political strategy as well. There was a decision made in that movement that making women the face of this movement would make it harder for their opponents, be they Democrats or abortion rights supporters, to attack them on the grounds that what they were doing was anti-gender equity, was anti-women, was anti-women's health, because they could bring out women legislators or activists or governors or attorney generals as the face of the movement. So it is both a reflection of sort of the reality and intimacy of the issue and also of like the real politic of it, I think, for the anti-abortion movement.
And even as women became the face of the movement for the anti-abortion side, there were still very key players who were men, right? I think about Vice President Mike Pence, certainly Leonard Leo, the architect of the Federalist Society, whose vision was largely behind the choices for the three Supreme Court justices that President Trump was able to put on the court during his term. And, you know, they too, interestingly, had personal stories related to kids and pregnancy, as well as faith, that really shaped the direction that they wanted to take their own political ambitions.
I want to ask you, you include Hillary Clinton's response to the 2022 ruling. She said, quote, "One thing I give the right credit for is they never give up. They are relentless. You know, they take a loss, they get back up, they regroup, they raise more money. We have nothing like it on our side," end quote. Curious whether you agree, and if so, does abortion then embody the long-held stereotypes of Republicans being better at messaging and cohesion?
You know, it was interesting. We did a really extensive interview, perhaps her most extensive on this topic, with Hillary Clinton. And, you know, her life really encapsulates this Roe era that we're talking about. And I think on that, she does have a point. I mean, what she's really getting at is the asymmetry of this fight. I think Democrats and abortion rights supporters thought of it as, if we just elect some senator or House member or president who supports abortion rights, we will have someone in office who will protect this thing that we cherish, and we will be safe, right? So they were thinking about it in these 2 or 4 year cycles. I think on the right and the anti-abortion movement, they were thinking about it in a much longer time frame. They were thinking about it in terms of generations. How do we build up, look, Democrats, they would say, are telling out their own OBGYNs who talk about how abortion rights are necessary for women's health. So how do we set up an institution with our own, you know, OBGYNs who are opposed to abortion? How do we change the courts? How do we transform the politics and how this is talked about? How do we inch the goalposts back and back and back until, in terms of the number of weeks where abortion could be legal, until we hit that Roe standard, right? So they're thinking about this in terms of generations, which I think Elizabeth will say, I'm sure, is deeply rooted in their like religious Christian roots, and how you think about an issue when you're thinking about it in terms of politics versus in terms of the arc of religion. So I think that's part of what Secretary Clinton was getting at there. And I do suspect she's right about that.
And one of the things we kept learning a lot as we were doing the reporting was we really, really feel strongly that if you understand the story of how Roe fell, like what the right was doing specifically in this generational thinking, the long-term planning, you will have the tools to understand where this country is going on issues, not just about reproductive rights, but about many issues that have significant cultural impact. We note that the right, for them, the overturning of Roe wasn't an end. It was really a beginning. And it's so tied into not just the procedure itself of abortion, but really changing the entire culture and rolling back the sexual revolution, which is quite comprehensive. And I think that's something that Secretary Clinton was getting at here in thinking about the massive stakes that her own movement and party is up against culturally when it comes to issues like trans rights, same-sex marriage, contraception, the place of religion in public life. And we're seeing this unfold in real time now in an array of decisions and changes in this country.
I'm curious, you mentioned this is one of the most extensive interviews that Secretary Clinton has granted on this topic. And it's very interesting to read in the book, as I did, and others will. But I'm curious, this, you know, we all know 2016, it looks like she's going to be president. Justice Scalia dies. It looks like Obama's going to have an appointment. And then if Clinton had gone on to be president, she would have appointed one or two justices herself. And the whole thing goes in a completely different direction. She's had a good 8 years solid to think about that, no doubt, as others have. And I'm just curious, it's one thing to read it. The body language, her demeanor, how painful is all of this? Because as you say, this issue is wrapped up in her career, her generation, and where everything was headed sort of as the climax of her career.
Look, I think she knows what a lot of people know, which is had she won that election in 2016, we would not have written this book, most likely, right? We'd be in a really different reality. Had she won that election, you know, a Clinton administration would have likely got 2, if not 3 appointments to the Supreme Court. She would have entered as the most aggressively pro-abortion rights president in history. She campaigned more assertively on that issue and had, you know, taken positions that were further out on that issue than any presidential candidate in history. She would have most likely pushed that agenda and expanded abortion rights, and the country would have been in a really different place. So I think when you talk to her, you get the sense that this is deeply painful and aggravated. She certainly has a sense that she warned the country of what was coming, and no one, she said to us, and people did not hear her, and they did not listen, that she was saying in her candidacy and her campaign, if you elect Donald Trump, Roe will fall. And it was just impossible for voters to believe. And in some ways, as we said earlier in this hour, you can't really blame them, right? It's really hard for people to see that something that has been part of their life for generations can suddenly disappear. It doesn't feel those kinds of, you know, quick legal reversals, quick in terms of like a generational term, you know, don't really happen that often in American life. And I think it was really hard for people to see that. But I do think Secretary Clinton feels a lot of frustration and sadness that what she was saying in that campaign wasn't heard, and that this is where the country is on this issue that she really spent her political life fighting for.
You mentioned, and we're coming up to a break, so I'm going to ask you to answer rather quickly, but you mentioned in the book that 1%, I think it's something like 1%, less than 1% of the court's 25,000 decisions since the founding of the country have been reversed. So given those odds, would abortion advocates be better off seeking codification through Congress or pursuing access state by state? You know, is there kind of a consensus on which direction they should go in?
Well, it's pretty clear that the Roe era is over, right? And we're not getting, Roe is not coming back. So whatever happens will need to be in a new form for a new era. And it's not simple getting a law passed in the states that can get up to the Supreme Court that can challenge precedent. That is a chessboard that the right figured out that the left is thinking about. And codification in Congress is actually not close. You know, when we talk to abortion rights advocates and they're, we're asking, you know, how long is this going to take? What we're not hearing is 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. The guesses are like 10 years, 20 years. Is it going to be 50 years, right? This is a very, very long game.
This is a shorter game. We're going to take one more break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the fall of Roe, the rise of a new America with Elizabeth Diaz and Lisa Laird. This is Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. We are discussing The Fall of Roe, The Rise of a New America, written by New York Times reporters Elizabeth Diaz and Lisa Lehrer. Lisa had to leave a little bit earlier. Elizabeth is staying with us, and she is going to handle all the questions from here on out. So, Elizabeth, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the mechanics of the Supreme Court and everything that we saw play out that led up to 2022. You go through in the book not only the nominations, but all of the hand-wringing that for decades went on with stare decisis, the precedent of Roe v. Wade, and then people are shocked when the vote goes the other way. And you write that, quote, the principle of stare decisis is just that, a principle, not a mandate, end quote. Given that and what played out, do you wonder why we spent so much time on precedent when it ended up really not mattering?
Well, the thing is, people didn't understand that it didn't end up mattering in this case. And there are, you know, every Supreme Court nomination and confirmation proceeding in the Senate, whether the candidate for the position was nominated by a Republican president or a Democratic president, everyone is asked specifically about Roe. And would they rely on precedent and treat Roe as the law of the land, or would they seek to overturn it? And everybody, one by one, always said, you know, Roe is precedent and must be respected as such. The thing that many Americans just missed is that precedents occasionally can change. And it became this sort of just ritual of we ask about precedent, the justice says, oh, they're not going to change anything. And even when senators on the Judiciary Committee press, people end up, you know, the outcome is the same. So it reveals, in a way, the norms and the trust, the sort of just the underlying bedrock, or what people think is bedrock, that guide how our politics run. And that we're in this time, this era of norms being broken and shattered. And that creates great turbulence for our entire political system. So I think, you know, now the question, when we've had one Supreme Court nomination confirmation since the Dobbs case, the case that overturned Roe, and Justice Jackson said, you know, when she was asked about precedent, she noted there was a new precedent on the court, which is the Dobbs case. So it's, I think it's important for the public to understand the real stakes, right, behind what's going on. And it can be really hard to see in the moment, just because of this trust. You know, it's interesting, the right used this existing system of democracy to accomplish their goals. It would be tempting, I think, for some observers to think, oh, they broke democracy, they went against democracy, but they were effective because they didn't break any laws, right? Mm-hmm. That's not how this happened. They passed laws, they got them through the courts, right? And so it begs a bigger question, I think, about what is the existing system that we have in this country, and are there vulnerabilities in that system?
We spoke at the top of the hour about, at least referred to, the obvious with the presidential election and how the abortion issue has factored into every election since the decision in 2022. And of course, we recently had the first debate. And you write in the book about President Trump and former President Trump and how his views have kind of gone all over the place, although with his Supreme Court nominations, he obviously was a huge factor in the fall of Roe. But I want to play you a clip from what he said during the debate. And this is his opinion on how we got where we are right now.
51 years ago, you had Roe v. Wade, and everybody wanted to get it back to the states. Everybody, without exception. Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives. Everybody wanted it back. Religious leaders. And what I did is I put three great Supreme Court justices on the court, and they happened to vote in favor of killing Roe v. Wade and moving it back to the states. This is something that everybody wanted.
Now, he went on to repeat a false and misleading interpretation of a remark by former Governor Ralph Northam, a misrepresentation mentioned in your book that Trump invokes again here.
The problem they have is they're radical, because they will take the life of a child in the eighth month, the ninth month, and even after birth. After birth, if you look at the former governor of Virginia, he was willing to do this. He said, we'll put the baby aside and we'll determine what we do with the baby, meaning we'll kill the baby. What happened is we brought it back to the states, and the country is now coming together on this issue. It's been a great thing.
So, Elizabeth, fact check that for us a little bit. I know there's a lot in that, but for the audience, take us through the instant reaction of what's wrong or incorrect in those statements.
Well, I was actually live fact checking this for the New York Times during the debate, and went and was pointing out from, you know, the moment he started talking about this, the false statements. I mean, first he says everybody wanted this. Everyone wanted Roe v. Wade overturned in this outcome, and that is false. A significant majority of Americans did not want Roe overturned. They supported Roe before it was overturned. They continue to support Roe after it was overturned. And there's actually been increased support for abortion rights since this decision. And of course, it was not a unanimous decision at the Supreme Court. It was the justices who, you know, certainly the three that he got onto the court that made the difference in this case. And there were three dissenting voices who wrote very strongly in their dissent about the dangers that they saw of this decision for the country. And, you know, you can go on from there. I mean, when he says, certainly this claim about infanticide, the Democrats support infanticide, that is also false. And it has been a messaging point for the anti-abortion movement for years now, a misreading and a twisting really of Governor Northam's words several years back now. It's a bit complicated, but the conversation that where that quote originally came from, he was talking about very complicated situations when a fetus is non-viable and is delivered. How do you decide about palliative care for that for that child, and what those really tormented moments are for that family? So they're not talking about infanticide, it's a complete misrepresentation. So it's the way that former President Trump talks about the issue now. We're seeing, in a way, he's trying to gather support from the anti-abortion movement, which were some of the most devout supporters of his, and relying on both old language that was misleading as well as the new talking point, which is just patently false.
So I'm curious with, not just what he's saying, but you have plenty of examples in the book of, for example, the 15-week viability that led to the Dobbs case, that led to the Supreme Court decision. It was really a random number. It wasn't based on science, right? You go through a number of examples of anti-abortion talking points, statements that are not grounded in scientific fact at all. They are rhetoric. And I'm curious, because you're taking a neutral, dispassionate, clinical view of this, is it fair to say that the anti-abortion side is skewing, or does skew much more heavily into disinformation than the pro-choice side?
Mm-hmm. Well, the examples we go through in the book are really documenting the strategy that was quite effective in getting the court to overturn Roe. And part of that was a litigation strategy, right? We think about legislation often as happening because a majority of people want something and they believe something. It's kind of in the culture, and that trickles down to our politics, and then that becomes law from there. But what the story of the fall of Roe showed is that the opposite can actually be true, and it was in this case, that power comes first, and you can have a minority of people, not a majority, but with a certain view, and if they're able to pull the levers of power, they can create the law that then sets mm-hmm. the contours that then shape the culture. So the question for the anti-abortion activists was how to do that in this case. And it's a reason, you look back and we saw this deluge of laws in states mm-hmm. across the country with a myriad of abortion restrictions. And it was part of a strategy to identify what would be the most effective. So the case that you're referencing in Mississippi, there was actually, it was a strategic move to find a magic number of weeks that would trigger a Supreme Court challenge to Roe. And so they tried 15 in Mississippi. They tried after that just to ensure that they would have something that worked. They tried 18 weeks in Utah and Arkansas, but by then the 15-week case was advancing. And they built a very robust case around 15 weeks that included what seemed like medical reasoning for the case. They put that in the legislative findings of the bill to build a case around what they talked about as fetal pain. And this is part of the way the right built their own institutions to buttress their own studies on things when the mainstream medical establishment said that their findings were incorrect and had no basis in actual scientific reality. So I think for many of the people in the movement, they actually do believe their own facts, right? Their own set of scientific studies. And they're, you know, it's in some ways, it's an example of echo chambers in the way that our society is increasingly segmented and people truly believe different things. It's not so simple as saying they're intentionally deceiving everybody, right? They actually believe something that's very different, which then creates great conflict for everybody else. But you can definitely see in the anti-abortion movement the roots of you know, what came to famously be referred to as, quote, alternative facts by Kellyanne Conway, that reference is a very different way of looking at the world.
You know, I mentioned earlier, former President Trump has had a number of shifting views on abortion. For example, there was, I think maybe you wrote the story recently that he had referred to the Florida 6-week abortion limit and Governor DeSantis's policy, you know, as flawed, terrible mistake. But obviously we know what happened in 2022, and you mentioned Marjorie Dannenfelser and how a federal ban on abortion is really the ultimate goal for her organization. So with all those things bubbling up, and the plank still to be determined for the Republican National Convention, that's got to be updated as well, and there's some controversy about that. How much of, I guess, internal battle do you expect to see over abortion policy within the Republican Party this time around?
Well, we're seeing it right now. I mean, this has been one of the dominant stories, actually, since the fall of Roe, is the way that the Republican Party itself and its relationship to some of its most staunch supporters, anti-abortion community, is being completely shaken up and changed in the last 2 years. I mean, we have to remember, this is the first presidential election after the Roe era has ended. And for half a century, there was a foundation that was built. What Roe existed, right? It was just what was at the ground floor, right, of how politics operated. And the Republican Party built a very successful alliance with anti-abortion activists, or maybe I should say anti-abortion activists built a very successful alliance with the Republican Party. And were able to use the party, especially over this last decade, to achieve their goals. But we're watching in real time right now that get shaken up. And we can see that most clearly in the new tensions with former President Trump, right? It's not as simple for him anymore to just support everything that they want. And he's actually spoken very loudly about his opposition to Marjorie Dannenfelser. And we hear him trying to have it both ways sometimes. I mean, he's at once both saying no, he wants this to stay just for the states and to not have a federal ban. And he's also giving you know, video addresses to some of the foremost anti-abortion activists in the country, abortion abolitionists at the Southern Baptist Convention, who want nothing more than the complete end of abortion rights in America.
And you write about Democrats have plenty of their own problems. And of course, with the recent debate, among the many things that went wrong for President Biden, there were plenty of people who were not satisfied with his answer on abortion. And that, when I say many people who are in favor of access to abortion. And he's always been a little bit distant with that issue. And at the same time, you have these undercurrents of racial and income differences that affect abortion access. So given all that, I know that's a huge question, but what do you expect the Democrats to do as they run up to the election in November?
Well, President Biden's answer about Roe in the debate was not satisfactory in any way for abortion rights activists. And in many ways, this is the best issue that Democrats have for this election. And it was a real crisis for them to not see the leader of their party champion that above all.
That is Elizabeth Dias. She has the last word. Her co-author, Lisa Lehrer, was with us earlier in the show. They are the co-authors of the new book, The Fall of Roe, The Rise of a New America. Elizabeth, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having us.
For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks so much for listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.